I grew up in an evangelical church in Korea. The pastors I knew as a child were passionate about the gospel. Korea had just come through the devastation of the war in the 1950s. In the 1960s and 70s were years of rebuilding. At the same time, the Korean church was experiencing remarkable growth and revival. When the world-famous evangelist Billy Graham visited, it felt like the whole nation was talking about it. In those revival years, pastors carried enormous authority in the pulpit. The biblical heroes they preached about became role models for everyone. We studied Abraham, Moses, David, Daniel, Paul, Peter, and people wanted to be like them. Some even took biblical names for themselves, hoping to follow their example. It was only later, when I began studying theology, that I discovered something important. The Bible is not only about great heroes. This was full of people who lived in the shadow of those heroes. People overlooked, misunderstood, were pushed to the margins. Yet they too were part of God's story. They too experienced God's grace. And they too have something to teach us. I began to realize that when we read scripture through the eyes of those on the margins, our understanding of God grows wider and deeper. So now, when I read the Bible, I pay special attention to the hidden characters, the ones we assume and judge too quickly. Honestly, I think there is often more to learn from their mistake than from simply trying to imitate the daunting heroes. Instead of spending my energy trying to become another Moses or another David, I find that more helpful to learn from those who stood in their shadow. Have you ever heard the phrase, reading the Bible from the margins? Or what is worse, reading the Bible from the damned? This morning, I want to show you how that perspective has shaped my reading of one very familiar story. Our text is Genesis 25:19-34, the story of Jacob and Esau. Most of us know it well. We think we know the lesson. Simple. Esau is foolish. Jacob is clever. Esau loses the blessing. Jacob receives it. Esau represents the flesh, Jacob the spirit. Esau is the bad soil, Jacob the good soil. And finally, Jacob becomes the ancestor of God's chosen people. Esau is simply rejected and forgotten. For years, Christians have read this story in black and white. But is God's grace really that limited? Is God's work in the world divided so neatly into heroes and failures, and winners and losers? I don't think so. So let me ask you, with whom do you identify in this story? Jacob or Esau? For most of my life, I identified with Jacob. I wanted to be the one who received the blessing. I wanted to be the one whose smartness outperforms people's foolishness. So today, I want us to stand where Esau stands and read this story through his eyes. Who was Esau, really? We've been taught to see Esau as a cautionary tale. The man who sold his birthright for a bowl of stew. The failure, the loser. But look at the text again, more slowly this time. Esau was not a schemer. He was not calculating or cruel. In a family full of deception, Esau was almost painfully straightforward. He came in from the field exhausted and starving, and he said exactly what he felt. I am about to die. What good is a birthright to me? No manipulation, no hidden agenda, but a hungry man telling the truth. Compare that to Jacob, who had the stew ready and waiting, who had already planned the exchange, who knew exactly what he was doing and did it anyway. If we are honest, Jacob is the more troubling figure. He calculated, he deceived, he dressed his brother's clothes and lied to his blind, dying father's face. And yet, Jacob is a hero of our Sunday school lessons, and Esau is the warning. Why? Because we've confused outcome with character. God chose Jacob, and so we've retroactively made Jacob the good one and Esau the bad one. But God's choice was not a moral report card. It was grace, plain and unearned. Scripture says this directly. Romans 9:11 tells us that before the twins were even born, before either had done anything good or bad, God's purpose in election was already set. God chose Jacob before either of them had done a single thing. Esau's failure didn't cause his rejection, and Jacob's scheming didn't earn his selection. This is the first thing we need to hear. God's grace is not a reward for the right kind of person. Now consider what Esau actually did and why this hits so close to home. He came in hungry, and in that hunger, he made a trade he could never undo. This isn't just an ancient story. This is just Tuesday. We live inside an economic system built on manufactured hunger. Consumer capitalism runs on keeping us just unsatisfied enough to want the next thing. Contentment doesn't serve the quarterly earnings report, so we stay hungry. For a bigger house, for a better life, for a newer car, a more impressive life. We scroll through other people's highlight reels and feel the ache of not enough. We work longer hours to afford the things that are supposed to make us feel like we've arrived. And when we get there, the goalposts move again. This is just hunger scaled up to an entire civilization. And in that hunger, we make trades. We trade our Sundays for productivity or pleasure, our marriages for careers, our children's childhood for financial security. We trade the slow, quick work of spiritual formation, for the quick high of a conference or a worship playlist. We trade the eternal for the immediate every single day. The book of Hebrews calls Esau godless. The Greek word is bebelos. It doesn't mean wicked. It means unable to tell the difference between the sacred and the ordinary. Unable to feel the weight of what is eternal versus what is merely temporary. This isn't a first century problem. This is a defining spiritual crisis of North America today. We have lost the ability to feel the weight of holy things. When was the last time you sat in silence long enough to feel the difference between what is sacred and what is just loud? When was the last time you chose the slow, invisible walk of prayer over something that would productive on your calendar? Esau didn't sell his birthright because he was evil. He sold it because he has lost the capacity to feel its weight. The question this morning isn't how could he? The question is how often do we? There's a detail in the story we almost always skip past. Genesis 25:28 tells us that Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Read that slowly. This family was divided, father and mother, each favoring a different son. And when the moment of crisis came, it was his mother who masterminded the deception against Esau. Esau wasn't just outmaneuvered. He was betrayed by his own family, by the people who were supposed to be safest. When he discovered what had happened, Scripture says, he cried out with an exceedingly great and bitter cry. That is not a tantrum. That's a sound of man whose world has collapsed, whose identity has been stolen, whose family openly chose someone else. We live in a culture full of this kind of wound. People who grew up where love was conditional, where approval was always out of reach, where someone else seemed to be the favorite. People who have built their whole lives trying to prove they are enough to a parent, to a culture, to a God they aren't sure even sees them. They carry that wound into their ambition, their consumption, their relentless hunger for more and better. Because maybe if they achieve enough, the ache will finally stop. Esau's cry is their cry. Bless me also, me too. Don't I matter? Here is what I need to hear. God does not turn away from that cry. He hears the wounds beneath the anger. He sees the child beneath the ambition. And 20 years pass. Jacob has been running from the consequences of his deception, and now he's coming home terrified. He sends a gift ahead. He divides his family into groups. He spends the night wrestling with God and begging for protection because he knows what he did to his brother. And he's certain Esau hasn't forgotten. Esau arrives with 400 men. And then Genesis 33:4. But Esau ran to meet him, embraced him, and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. Esau ran, not Jacob, Esau. The one who was wronged, the one who lost everything, the one with every right to arrive with cold calculation and a list of grievances. He ran, he embraced, he wept. If that sounds familiar, it should. In Luke 15:20, the father of the prodigal son ran and embraced him and kissed him. The same word, the same image, the same posture. I believe that when Jesus painted the picture of the running father, the most beloved image of grace in all of Scripture, he was drawing on the memory of Esau. The man we made the villain, the man who embodied grace before any of us recognized it as grace. Esau forgave fully and freely, without demanding an explanation or an apology sufficient to earn it. He simply ran toward the brother who had ruined him and hurt him. In a culture that interprets holding grudges, boundaries, and cutting people off, self-care, where the prevailing logic is that you are only obligated to forgive people who have sufficiently earned it, Esau's run is a revolution. One more thing needs to be said clearly. We assume Esau was thrown away, that God chose Jacob and discarded his brother, and that isn't what happened. Esau became the father of an entire nation. He settled in the hill country of Seir. His descendant became the Edomites, a people with their own land, their own identity, their own place in the story of the world. Isaac blessed him too in Genesis 27:39-40. Not the covenant blessing, but the blessing nonetheless. When Paul writes in Romans 9:13, Jacob I loved, but Esau I hated. He is quoting Malachi, and neither writer means emotional hatred. In the covenantal language of the ancient world, hate means chose second. God chose Jacob's line as the vehicle of the Messianic covenant. That's a statement about redemptive history, not about whether God loved Esau as a person. God didn't discard Esau. He simply moved the covenant line through Jacob. This matters for us. North American Christianity has quietly observed the prosperity gospel's logic, even where it has rejected its theology outright. We've come to believe, somewhere beneath our doctrine, that God's blessing looks like success. That the chosen ones get the corner office, the healthy family, the platform, the influence. That if your life looks like Jacob's, ascending, expanding, recognized, God is with you. And if your life looks like Esau's, passed over, displaced, starting over in the hill country, maybe God isn't. That's a lie. Esau's story exposes it. God's covenant love isn't disputed according to your place in the visible hierarchy. The one who ends up in the hill country is not the one God forgot. Sometimes the hill country is exactly where God intended you to be, building something smaller, quieter, and more real than the thing you thought you were old. Esau is not the villain of this story. Esau is the mirror. He is a part of us that is always hungry and doesn't always know what we are really hungry for. He is a part of us that makes trades we later regret. Not because we are evil, but because in the moment, the immediate felt more real than the eternal. He is the wounded son, still looking for the father's blessing, secure enough to rest in. He is the one who was passed over and had to build a life in the space between what he expected and what he received. And at his best, he's the one who ran, who forgave before he was asked, who held the person who wronged him and wept with him instead of over him. In a culture of relentless consumption and carefully curated grievance, Esau's run is the most countercultural act in the book of Genesis. So where are you in this story today? Are you still making Esau's trade, exchanging the weight of sacred things for whatever feels urgent right now? Are you still carrying Esau's wound, building your life around the hunger for blessing you are afraid will never come? Or are you ready to make Esau's run toward the person, the relationship, the part of your story you've been avoiding, and choose grace before it's required of you? Knowing all this, would you still look at Esau and see a villain? This is the true power of reading the Bible from the margins. It enables us to see others differently. But even more than that, it changes who we are.